Well, thank you for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be back here. And today I'll be telling you about this recent work, which we reported in this paper posted in Archive at the beginning of the year, on a Parquet-RG approach to these moiré heterostructures. So, you know, condensed matter has so often advanced through advances on the materials front, and we're very lucky to have these moiré superlattices come on the screen with all this, you know, wonderful new experimental data and all of these new phases. And the challenge to us theorists is really how to understand this. Now, theorists are limited beings. We can only understand problems in limits. One possibility, of course, is to start from the strong coupling limit and view things as doped mod insulators and start working on that front. And there's been lots of beautiful work taking that approach. But there is a second point of view where you could say that, well, maybe the problem can be adequately understood starting from weak coupling. And the right way to proceed is to start with a Fermi surface and examine the instabilities of a Fermi surface. And of course, empirically, as best as we know, the coupling is neither strong nor weak. It's something in between. So we don't know if either approach is really valid. It could be that some systems are well described by strong coupling. Some other systems are well described by weak coupling. In this talk, I will throughout be taking a weak coupling perspective. Now, I'm agnostic as to whether any particular experiment is well described by weak coupling, but there's so many moiré heterostructures coming out that I hope that at least some of them will be well described by a weak coupling point of view.
So you're not in the flat band limit?
Well, the bands are fairly flat, but I'm assuming that the interaction matrix element is smaller than the bandwidth. Now, as best as we know, the interaction matrix element is of the same order as the bandwidth. So there's no small parameter. It's not the case that the interaction matrix element is 10 times bigger than bandwidth, and it's not the case that it's 10 times smaller than bandwidth. They're of the same order. So either approach could be fine. It's also possible that in some systems, the bandwidth is bigger and weak coupling is fine, and in other systems, the bandwidth is smaller and strong coupling is better. I'm going to take the weak coupling perspective here, where I'm going to assume that the interaction matrix elements are weak compared to bandwidth, and I will run with it. And maybe some of the, I hope that at least some of the moiré heterostructures will be well described by this sort of approach. So an obvious challenge to any weak coupling approach to the problem is that empirically, we know that the ordering energy scales are quite a large fraction of the Fermi energy, much larger than you would expect based on PCS type analyses. So is there a way to get enhanced energy scales out of a weak coupling approach? Well, yes, there is, and that's to make use of Van Hoff singularities. So in two dimensions, Van Hoff singularities generically arise in bands, and they're accompanied by a log diversion density of states. And near the Van Hoff singularity, the diversion density of states gives rise to a much stronger instability. So instead of the standard BCS type logarithmic instabilities of the Fermi surface, you actually have log squared instabilities of the Fermi surface, and this can greatly enhance the energy scales for any instability. Moreover, tuning to the Van Hoff singularity in moiré subbands should be relatively easy because the bandwidth is small, so you should be able to tune there with gating. Furthermore, if the Fermi surface near Van Hoff singularity is nested, then you get a rich zoo of possible instabilities. So now, this is the basic assumption I'm going to take. I'm going to assume that I have a system that's well described by weak coupling, which may or may not be valid for any particular experimental system, but hopefully is valid for at least some of the systems.
You can check connection again. It's shaking a little bit.
Which?
No, it's not.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't like weak coupling. It's shivering.
So I'm going to assume the system is well described by weak coupling. I'm going to work close to Van Hoff singularity, and you'll use the diversion density of states to enhance the energy scale. And I will further assume that the Fermi surface is nested, and I will explore what happens close to a Van Hoff singularity with a nested Fermi surface. So, you know, this is an approach that's not original to me. It has a long history. It was first pursued on the square lattice. So if you're dealing with a square lattice system and your model is described by a nearest neighbor tight binding model, then at half filling, the Fermi surface takes the form of a diamond nested within the Brillouin zone. And this diamond has two special features. Firstly, these two edges of the Fermi surface are parallel, as are these two edges. So that's the nesting I referred to. And secondly, the corners of this diamond are saddle points of the dispersion, and they give rise to a diversion density of states. And there are two inequivalent saddle points, M and M prime. Now, the existence of the Van Hoff singularity is a topological quantity. You can move it around, but the Van Hoff singularity will always be there. The nesting is kind of accidental. The moment you put in further neighbor hoppings, the nesting will be spoiled. But let's presume that we have this diamond Fermi surface and run with it. If you have this diamond Fermi surface with these, with this diversion density of states and this particle hole and this nested Fermi surface, then you get instabilities in multiple channels, both particle-particle and particle-hole. The particle-hole instabilities are associated with the nesting of the Fermi surface. The particle-particle instabilities come from feedback of spin fluctuations back into the particle-particle sector. And this is a problem that was solved by sort of heroes of the 1980s, and it was solved using the technique of Parquet-RG analysis. So the idea is that you progressively integrate out the high energy states and you examine the flow of couplings. You get logarithmic divergences in perturbation theory. There's three sources of log divergence. There's the standard Cooper log, there's nesting, and there's the diversion density of states. You get log squared divergences as the leading order. And what the Parquet does is it sums up all the log squared divergences and you get a one loop RG analysis for leading logs. So this was done by such luminaries as Schultz and Zalozhinsky and Furukawa and Rice. And what was found was that at the leading log squared order, the antiferromagnet, that is the commensurate spin density wave state, and the D-wave superconductor were degenerate. So then you have to incorporate subleading single log corrections to the leading log RG. And when you take the subleading single logs into account, you conclude that the antiferromagnet dominates at half filling. And then when you dope away from half-filling, this gives way to the D-wave superconductor.
So, yes. Rahul, just mean field theory doesn't care about whether the coupling is weak or strong. Will also give you antiferromagnetism, right?
Yes, but it will not give the superconductor.
That it would not. That happens only at doping.
Yes.
Where the theory may not be as well controlled.
Yes. Right?
And in the weak coupling limit, they are even exactly degenerate at half-filling, right?
Yes.
And
yes.
Also the D-density wave, which is just by symmetry related to the D superconductor. It's normally not looked at, but you can...
Okay. I don't think that's discussed in Zalozhinsky and Schultz, but that may be
so. It's later. Yeah.
And also, this degeneracy is a property of fixed point.
Yes.
If you stop RG...
Yes, yeah. So if you stop RG before you float at the fixed point. Yep.
Yeah. Or if you...
So, plus, of course, the incorporation of the subleading single logs is pretty messy. About 8 years ago now, I played this game on the honeycomb lattice. And on the honeycomb lattice, the story is quite a lot cleaner. So if you're working at the right filling on the honeycomb lattice, which is the doping level corresponding to the M point, then the Fermi surface takes the form of a hexagon nested within the Brillouin zone. So normally for graphene, you work close to the K point, where the Fermi surface is small circles on the corners of the Brillouin zone. But here we're not working near the K point, we're working near the M point, where the Fermi surface is this hexagon nested within the Brillouin zone. The hexagon displays nesting, so this edge and this edge are parallel, this edge and this edge are parallel, this edge and this edge are parallel. And moreover, the corners of the hexagon are saddle points of the dispersion, and they give rise to a logarithmic divergence in the density of states. So this problem has the same key features as the square lattice problem. It has the nested Fermi surface, it has log divergent density of states. And moreover, the nesting of the Fermi surface is a bit more robust in the honeycomb lattice than it is on the square lattice. So in the square lattice, the moment you put in second neighbor hopping, the nesting goes away. In the honeycomb lattice, the nesting is actually robust to second neighbor hopping. You have to put in third or further neighbor hopping to start to spoil the nesting. And in graphene, at any rate, the further neighbor hoppings are believed to be weak. So hopefully this is a good approximation. And so then you could ask the question that given this Van Hoff singularity in the density of states and the strong nesting of the Fermi surface, what happens? I'm skipping fairly quickly through this material because this is things that happened 8 years ago, and I hope that some fraction of the audience at least is familiar with this, but I should cover it for pedagogical completeness. So we tackled the problem in the same way that the square lattice problem was tackled. You do this Parquet RG analysis to one loop order, very similar to Schultz and Zalozhinsky. What you find is that the RG flows to a unique strong coupling limit. So it doesn't matter what the bare interactions are. As long as they are repulsive and sufficiently weak, you always flow to strong coupling along the same direction in parameter space. So there's an unambiguous answer at weak coupling. You always get the same leading instability. You can ask, when does a problem flow to strong coupling? When does the system display an ordering instability? Well, the temperature scale is enhanced. So the standard BCS theory has an ordering temperature, which is exponentially small in the bare coupling. Here you get an ordering temperature, which is exponentially small in the square root of the bare coupling. And that's because you've got these log squared divergences instead of the standard log divergences. And if the coupling is small, then square root of the coupling is less small. And so, and moreover, this sits in the exponent. So this can represent a very large enhancement of the ordering temperature. You can ask, what sort of ordering do you get? Well, as on the square lattice, the main players in the game are the spin density wave and the D-wave superconductor. But unlike the square lattice, here you find that the D-wave superconductor unambiguously wins at the leading log squared order for weak coupling. So there's no insulating state in the phase diagram here. You just get the superconductor close to Van Hove doping. There's a nice way to understand this, which is, now, what changed when we went from square lattice to honeycomb lattice? Well, the important thing that changed is we changed the number of saddle points. So on the square lattice, we had 2 inequivalent saddle points. On the honeycomb lattice, we have 3 inequivalent saddle points. And when we enlarge the number of saddle points, we enhance the phase space for the Cooper channel. Because now Cooper pairs can scatter from here to there or from here to there. So Cooper pairs have a larger phase space for scattering. But we do not enlarge the phase space for density wave orders, because density waves involve a particular nesting vector. So on the square lattice, at weak coupling, leading log order, the density waves and the superconductor were degenerate. Then we enlarge the phase space for superconductivity while leaving the phase space for the density waves unchanged. And the end result is that you end up tipping the balance towards superconductivity. Right? As a side benefit, on the square lattice, the D-wave pairing is nodal, whereas on the honeycomb lattice, the pairing instability occurs in a doubly, in a two-dimensional irrep, so it's doubly degenerate, guaranteed by symmetry. The dxy and dx squared minus y squared orders are degenerate. And the interplay of those two orders below the ordering temperature cannot be addressed through RG. You need some sort of Landau-Ginzburg procedure. And you do the Landau-Ginzburg, and you find that you want to have both orders coexist in order to fully gap the Fermi surface. And the resulting state is chiral D plus ID. OK, so that's what happened on the honeycomb lattice. Now, doping graphene to that level is really hard. And Dima yesterday was talking about how they tried for a long time very hard to get up to the right doping level. It's pretty hard to get there with graphene. Maybe you can get there in strontium platinum arsenic. Maybe this theory is relevant to strontium platinum arsenic. Certainly, my former Princeton colleague Titus Neupert used to tell me that it was. But this is not a talk about strontium platinum arsenic. This is a talk about moiré. So let's finally get down to business with moiré. So we want to describe moiré systems. And I want to take a weak coupling perspective. And I want to work close to a Van Hove singularity. So at the most basic level, you could say that, well, OK. So I will model, I will take the Yuan Fu type model, where I will model the system as essentially a honeycomb lattice system with some large moiré unit cell. And I will work close to the endpoint. Because of the large moiré unit cell, I should be able to neglect further neighbor hoppings. So I should be able to well approximate it by a honeycomb lattice model with nearest neighbor hoppings, or maybe first and second neighbor hoppings. And in that case, I know I get this nice hexagonal Fermi surface. So if I'm at the right filling, I should be back to my hexagonal Fermi surface with saddle points at the corners. And now it should be the same analysis that I did before. Or should it? Well, there's one important difference. And the key difference is that in graphene, the only degeneracy in the problem was spin degeneracy. In these moiré problems, there's an orbital degeneracy on top of the spin degeneracy. So instead of having 2 flavors of fermions, we have many more flavors of fermions. And there's some disputes about whether it should be 4 flavors or 8 flavors, so whether my problem should have an SU4 flavor symmetry or an SU8 flavor symmetry. My answers are actually not going to depend on that. All that will matter is that I have an SUN flavor symmetry, and N is bigger than 2. And my answers will be universal for N bigger than 2. So I go back to my analysis, where I have this hexagonal Fermi surface that's nested inside the Brillouin zone. The corners of this hexagonal Fermi surface are saddle points of the dispersion, and there are three different nesting vectors. And I have an SUN flavor symmetry, where n is bigger than 2. And now I can say, well, what are the basic couplings? Well, remember, what I'm doing here is a parquet RG analysis, which is much simpler than FRG because it has much less detail put in. So I sort of approximate with patches centered on the corners, which is where most of the density of states is. And then I have basically just four basic interactions, and these are constants, they're not functions. There's this interaction, which is a sort of exchange interaction between patches. There's this interaction, which is a density-density interaction between patches. There's this interaction, which is an interaction within the same patch. And there's also this term, which is an umklopp term. Two fermions on one patch scatter to a different patch. And the umklopp term is allowed because a nesting vector is one half of a reciprocal lattice vector. And this is a key difference from, for instance, the parquet RG, which Liang Fu presented. Because in Liang Fu's parquet RG, the saddle points are not on the zone boundary. So there's no umklopp process in the problem. And so the presence of umklopp is going to change the RG in quite an essential way. And so you can't straightforwardly compare these results to the results that Liang got. OK, so you can do this, and you can evaluate the beta functions. Now, on the one hand, we have much less detail than the FRG. So we've thrown away a lot of detail about what happens away from the saddle points. On the other hand, this much greater simplicity has some advantages. One advantage is you can solve the problem by hand. There's no computational black box involved. Another advantage is that the answers are completely independent of the details of the interaction. So I don't have to worry about computing the bare matrix elements. There will be one unique answer that I flow to. And all I need is that my bare interaction matrix elements are repulsive and weak. And as long as they are repulsive and sufficiently weak, I will get a unique answer. And finally, of course, at weak coupling, the problem is asymptotically exact. The analysis is asymptotically exact at weak coupling. So yes, Shankar.
Are these all the interactions consist of the symmetry of the problem? Because bilayer graphene, there's so many G's.
Right. So one more thing which I have imposed here is I have assumed that the interactions have SUN flavor symmetry.
OK, so that explains, once you put that in, they're just four independent
ones.
So that's not a simplicity. You have SUN.
Yeah.
What N are you using to get just four?
So I can do the calculation at arbitrary N.
OK.
But the character of the solution will change. So you will have one character of solution for n equals 2, which was the old analysis, and a different character of solution for anything bigger than 2.
So this is a simplification based on this SUN symmetry. OK, so
yes.
It's totally unlocked. OK, thanks.
Regarding this indifference with respect to the initial conditions, so what happens if you make one G negative, for example, or much smaller?
If you make some of the G's negative, then you could flow to different fixed points.
Yeah, okay. So
but there's a unique fixed point starting from weak repulsive interactions. So you can go ahead and you can compute the beta functions for these g constants. We'll just do it to one loop. And if you do it to one loop, you get the following beta function. So let me make some comments on what are the terms going in here. So the g's are the coupling constants. The y is the sort of rg time, which is a log squared rg time. This d1 coefficient quantifies the degree of nesting. So when this is 1, that's perfect nesting. When it's 0, that's no nesting. And it could be something in between, so you're allowed to interpolate for imperfect nesting. And then there are these two quantities, NF and NP. So NP is the number of inequivalent saddle points, the number of patches. So on the square lattice, it's 2. On the honeycomb lattice, it's 3. And NF is the number of flavors. So in our old analysis with only spin degeneracy, NF is 2. Here, it's 4 or 8 or something bigger than 2. But this set of RG equations is a general set of RG equations for any number of patches and any number of flavors. If you set NP equal to 2 and NF equal to 2, then you will get the square lattice equations from Zylozhinsky and Schultz. If you set NP equal to 3 and NF equal to 2, you will get our RG equations from 8 years ago. But what we want to look at now is NF bigger than 2. And straight away, you see that, well, there are certain terms which vanish when NF is equal to 2, because there are accidental cancellations between diagrams. And those terms don't vanish anymore in the beta function when NF is not equal to 2. And you also see that there are other terms in the beta functions which depend on NF. So the beta functions do change when you make the number of flavors anything other than 2, Raphael.
So your D1 is just a prefactor you put in front of the particle homology?
Yes.
So it's not really deviation from perfectness, because you would lose the log. You're just trying to unfavor it.
Yes.
You lose the log at the lower scale, you don't lose the higher scale. That's the way to manipulate.
So, no, here's my set of beta functions. Now. Yeah.
Sorry, remind us, what's NP's game?
The number of patches, number of saddle points.
Okay.
So on square lattice, it's 2. For honeycomb, it's 3. Yeah.
So we need to look at 3.
Most of this talk will be about 3. I'll briefly discuss 2 towards the end. So let's analyze these RG equations. So if I just stare at it, you know, what can I say right off the bat? Well, the first thing I can say is, well, if I look at the beta function for G2, this beta function is positive definite. So G2 will necessarily flow to strong coupling, right? So there can't be any finite coupling fixed points on the problem, because G2 will flow to strong coupling, and the others will do whatever. Now, if I look at G3, every term in the beta function for G3 is proportional to G3 itself. So if G3 starts out positive, then it can never turn negative. You know, G3 has to be positive semi-definite. So I know that G3 has to be non-negative, and I know that G2 has to flow to strong coupling. And that's about all I could do. If NF were equal to 2, then G1 would also be necessarily non-negative. But for NF bigger than 2, that's not the case anymore.
G4 will shrink?
And G4 will shrink, yeah. Or it could become negative.
No, it will become negative.
Yeah.
So it will shrink.
That's what it means. Yeah. It will go through 0 and then become negative.
That's what shrink means.
So, you know, how can we actually solve it? Well, you know, we can...
shrinking on the magnitude.
So, you know, how can we actually solve it? We can take tricks out of, you know, Oscar's book. So what we can do is we can say that, well, you know, G2 is monotonically increasing, so we will treat G2 as my RG time, and I will rewrite my flow equations as flow in terms of G2 instead of Y. I can take ratios of these couplings, so I can look at the flow of G1 over G3 and G4 over G3 with respect to G2, let's say. And now I've taken a set of 4 equations, and I've collapsed it down to a set of 2 equations. And now it's a set of, no, now I'm looking at a flow in the space of ratios of couplings. And I can solve for the fixed points, and that's just solving algebraic equations, so I'll get some number of fixed points. And I can analyze their stability. And what I find is that if you do this analysis, you know, starting from weak repulsive interactions, then there is a unique stable fixed point. So these equations have only one stable fixed point to which they can flow. That is, the problem flows to strong coupling, but it flows to strong coupling along a unique direction in parameter space. So if the interactions start off weak enough and repulsive, like, it doesn't matter what the bare values of the interactions are, you always go to the same instability. And remember, this is an asymptotically exact statement at weak coupling. Instability along that trajectory, you can try and get a, you find that the couplings diverge in the following way. And this divergence is characterized by these coefficients big G. You can take this ansatz, substitute it back into the RG equations. You get a set of algebraic equations, which you can solve for these coefficients GI. And these coefficients GI as a function of this nesting parameter D1 are plotted here. And, you know, as was pointed out, G4 becomes negative, G1 becomes negative, G2 and G3 stay positive. Okay, so this tells us how the problem flows to strong coupling. It does not tell us, at least yet, what happens when it flows to strong coupling. So that's the next challenge. So how can we tell what happens as this problem flows to strong coupling? Well, strictly speaking, once the problem flows to strong coupling, the RG is no longer controlled, so we don't know for sure what happens, but we can make a best guess. And the way to make the best guess is to introduce test vertices corresponding to all possible fermion bilinears, then calculate the susceptibility towards ordering in every channel, the way Oscar developed. And whichever channel has the most divergent susceptibility represents the leading instability, because ordering in that channel would appear to gain us the most energy at the scale that the problem flows to strong coupling. So what happens? Well, this is what happens. So I should explain this thought a little. So what you find is that the susceptibility in various channels is governed by a certain exponent. That exponent is plotted on the y-axis, and a negative exponent corresponds to a divergent susceptibility. So the leading instability here is the instability with the most negative exponent. What's on the x-axis is the nesting parameter. Now, if I was doing this with two flavors, as in our old analysis from 8 years ago, what you would find is that the D-wave superconductor always had the most negative exponent, and so it was always dominant. So.
6, not 8. Keep going.
No, it was 8 years, because it's 2019. That paper was, well, okay, it was published in 2012, but it was done in 2011. So, in the old analysis, the D-wave superconductor was always the most negative exponent, so it was always the dominant instability. But here the story is different. So if the nesting parameter is poor, if the problem is not that well nested, then yes, it's still the case that D-wave superconductivity is the dominant instability. However, if the nesting is good, then for close to perfect nesting, it's actually overtaken by a different pairing channel, and that's the imaginary charge density wave. So what do I mean, imaginary charge density wave? Question?
Yes, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
Suppose I'm a little bit concerned about what happens if D1 is equal to 0.
Mm-hmm.
If you look back in your RG equation,
yeah.
I guess you completely separate between particle-particle,
yes.
particle-hole
yeah.
channel. Particle-particle channel alone,
yeah.
It's a repulsive interaction.
Yes.
So everything should go to 0.
Yeah.
So how do you get negative exponent?
I'm guessing that when you do the solution, something pathological happens if you really set D1 equal to 0, that you get divisions by 0 somewhere.
The Jaloshinsky case, right? He had this square lattice. So
no, but just if you just look at the equations, you immediately find that.
Yes, but the analysis doesn't make sense when D1 is equal to 0.
I think D1 has to be solved for.
What?
Some small number.
Yeah, it has to be non-zero.
Right,
but
down to the equation.
Because the limit is singular.
Yeah.
It's Kohn-Luttinger, right? Otherwise, it's Kohn-Luttinger and with repulsive. It's not contained.
Right.
Kohn-Luttinger is not contained.
Right. If D1 is equal to 0, there is no Kohn-Luttinger here. Because it's completely separate particle, and particle.
Well, you could still do the Kohn-Luttinger analysis with no nesting.
No, I'm not talking about the equations. So this is really calculating, you write down second set of RG equations for the vertices, solve this and then substitute and solve for susceptibilities.
Yes.
Okay.
So we have this richer behavior than for true fermions where I said imaginary charge density wave. What does imaginary charge density wave mean? Well, by charge density wave I mean particle on one patch, hole on the other patch. Now, the nesting vector is commensurate with the lattice vector, so the charge density wave is commensurate. And because the charge density wave is commensurate, there's no sort of phase degree of freedom. You can write down a flow equation for a complex order parameter as a sort of matrix vector flow equation for delta and delta star. And its eigenvalues involve the plus combination, which is real, and the minus combination, which is imaginary. And the combination that starts dominating is the imaginary part of the charge density wave. And you should understand the imaginary charge density wave as essentially a loop current order. It means, imaginary charge density wave means currents.
Is it guaranteed that it's loop current?
I will come to that very shortly. So in this case, it is loop current.
If it's not loop, how can you describe your observation?
You can close it to the boundary of the sample.
So the leading instability, let's assume the nesting is good, then when you're at Van Hove filling, the leading instability is to an imaginary charge density wave channel. And then as you dope away from the Van Hove filling a little bit, then you move away from the nested Fermi surface, and then you should go back to the D-wave superconductor. So the basic picture here is that at Van Hove filling, you should have an imaginary charge density wave forming. And as you go away from Van Hove filling, this should give way to a D-wave superconductor. Now, as before, the D-wave pairing is in a doubly degenerate channel, and that really just follows from symmetries of the honeycomb lattice. D-wave is is a two-dimensional irrep. And so as before, the D-wave superconductor you would expect to be D plus ID when it forms. But what about the charge density wave? Well, the charge density wave is actually in a triply degenerate channel, because if you go back to this Fermi surface, there's actually three different nesting vectors, Q1, Q2, Q3, and you can make charge density wave order at any of those three nesting vectors. So the charge density wave order occurs in a triply degenerate channel. And then the question is, well, what actually happens? Do you want to have ordering at just one of them? Do you want to have ordering at two of them? Do you want to have ordering at all three? So this is a question that cannot be addressed within RG. You have to do a Landau-Ginzburg analysis. So we did the Landau-Ginzburg analysis, and the Landau-Ginzburg analysis tells you that below TC, you want to have ordering at all three charge density wave, at all three nesting vectors at the same time. So you want to have a 3Q order, where you simultaneously make charge density wave order along all three nesting vectors. And intuitively, this should make sense, because this kind of ordering gaps out the full Fermi surface. Like within the nested model, it gaps out the full Fermi surface. If you weren't fully nested, you might have some minimum strength to gap out the full Fermi surface. So this is a fully gap state. Now, you could ask, what symmetries does it break? Well, it breaks a Z4 spatial symmetry, which will be explained on the next slide. But in addition, it also breaks time reversal. Now, the fact that it breaks time reversal should be kind of obvious, because it's an imaginary order parameter, so of course it breaks time reversal. But if you had ordering along only one or two nesting vectors, then even though time reversal by itself is broken, time reversal plus some translation would be preserved. But when you have ordering at all three nesting vectors simultaneously, then time reversal is completely broken. You don't even preserve it up to translations. And it's completely broken because the state is, in fact, chiral. And this was pointed out with this nice paper by Venderbos. I think the archive version of it is 2016. Like maybe the published version is 2018. Yeah. So you know, this was pointed out in this nice paper by Venderbos, who pointed out that if you have triple Q charge density wave order on the honeycomb lattice, this will correspond to a state which is chiral in the sense that it is fully gapped and the valence band has a Chern number. So this is a state which is a Chern insulator. That is to say, it should display a quantized anomalous Hall effect. Now, there have been lots of proposals, and so I was very pleased to see that Karsten found the same state.
But for special interactions, we still have to discuss why.
Yeah, so here we don't need any special interactions. It's any choice of sufficiently weak but entirely repulsive interactions. There have been lots of proposals for quantized anomalous Hall effect in this system, but the state we're talking about here is actually different from all of the other proposals. Because as far as I know, all of the other papers to have proposed quantized anomalous Hall effect in the Moray systems involve magnetic order. So you take the spin degrees of freedom and you order them in some way, and this induces quantized anomalous Hall effect. The state I'm talking about here does not have any order in the spin sector or the value sector. It completely preserves SU4 symmetry. The quantized anomalous Hall effect here is purely an orbital phenomenon. So how to visualize this? Well, the way you visualize this is, loop currents you can also view as fluxes. So this is a pattern of flux order. On the honeycomb lattice, it looks something like this. You put plus fluxes, so you enlarge the unit cell. The new unit cell is this big. You put up fluxes through three hexagons and a big down flux through the fourth hexagon so that the net flux in each unit cell is zero. You could also play the same game on the triangular lattice, so you can also have this hexagonal Fermi surface appearing on the triangular lattice. And if you play this game on the triangular lattice, you get a bigger unit cell and you get some sort of picture that looks like this. But in either case, it's a staggered flux order where one quarter, well, I think this is the elementary unit cell on the triangular lattice. But it's a staggered flux order, you can put the big down flux on this hexagon or this hexagon or this hexagon or this hexagon, so that's why it breaks a Z4 symmetry. This is actually quite similar to some of the density wave states that Andre and Raphael and I worked on maybe 6 years ago. The end result is you do this Parker-RG analysis and you obtain a phase diagram that looks something like this. So at Van Hove filling, you have a Chern insulator, which exhibits quantum anomalous Hall effect, but without any structure in spin valley space. And then when you dope into this quantum anomalous Hall state, this gives way to a D plus ID superconductor. Okay, So now, so far, I was just telling you about properties of this toy model. Now let me sort of stick my neck out. What do we expect this to actually tell us about experimental systems? Well, now, I don't want to stand up here and say this describes Pablo's system, because I have no idea if it describes Pablo's system. In fact, maybe even I'm pessimistic about whether it describes Pablo's system. But there's so many Moray heterostructures that hopefully at least some of them should be well described by this sort of weak coupling approach. Yeah.
So before we get to experimental systems, this assumption that Van Hoff points at zone boundaries, is it an approximation or is it supported by some numerics?
It's certainly not supported by any numerics. Mm-hmm. If you reason that you can model the problem with reasonable accuracy as a essentially honeycomb lattice problem with an orbital degeneracy and with some large Moray unit cell, then you will get this, that the Van Hoff points are at the zone boundary, at the endpoint, because you have a honeycomb lattice model with nearest neighbor hoppings, or maybe first and second neighbor hoppings, and that's a property of that sort of honeycomb lattice model. Now, if you start deforming this model, there's no reason the Van Hoff point should remain at the zone boundary.
What if you introduce a boost angle?
I don't know what that does.
Well, that close, but not that high. Yeah. Can I ask a similar question, but slightly different?
Yeah.
Obviously, you explained the difference between your model and what Liang presented mm-hmm. last year. Obviously, if you do RG, that at the end of the day, the fact that Van Hoff points are not at zone boundary, instead play a role,
right.
And you hope that your instability happens before the
escape. Yeah.
Question is this. As far as that, you showed us what happens as a fixed trajectory after RG. If you start from bare model and start looking at what is the evolution of RG flow, I assume that at the beginning, the leading channel is spin density wave.
I think that's right, yeah.
Right. So what happens? Yeah. What is hierarchy? It gets replaced by what? By first D wave and then by...
So we haven't really looked into that, and also the answers will not be universal, right? Then that will start to depend on what pair interactions you put
in. It's true. But in general, it's...
So, if you tell me what pair interactions you would like to look at, we can put those in and look at
that. Right, but I guess it's almost certain that at the beginning it's spin density.
I think that's right.
So, going back to this question, more technical question about the fact that the Van Hoff may or may not be exactly at the zone boundary.
Mm-hmm.
So, to describe the absence of nesting, you very nicely put a D there.
Right.
Is there any kind of trick that you can do the same with the unclap? Because the unclap shouldn't just immediately vanish, right? There also should be. So, is there some smart way of
Put another constant in front of all unclap terms?
Well, but that's not going to make any difference, because that's the same as just changing the unclap term, and he found a fixed point, right? I don't think that that's the right way of doing that. It can't be that simple, because that just amounts for changing the interaction.
I think probably the way to do it is you cut off the flow of the unclap term at some scale.
Right, exactly.
Right.
And that probably you can do that in a pretty simplified way.
Right.
But it's the same what you do with any particle hole channel. At the end of the day, you cut the flow, right?
But you only want to cut the flow for the unclap term, not for the other normalizations through.
No, I mean that in one case you model this cutting of flow by a constant.
But here cannot be a constant. That's just something else.
What if maybe you can get something? What is to do this, and it's easier to do than talk about
it. Can it somehow move away by self energies, or split up?
So at one loop, no.
Yeah.
If you go to higher loops, maybe.
Yeah. But if you do perturbation theory, it's like these quadratic band crossing points, they can split up into four Dirac points, for example. But this is a different theory.
Now, at one loop, there's nothing weird in self energy. But at higher loops, maybe. I don't know.
We already moved into questions. So if you have something to say for one of the
questions. I mean, all I want to say is that, look, there was this experiment which seems to see some signs of hole conductance at zero field. So that's promising. Of course, they also see some hysteresis in magnetic field, which is not natural to explain within this quantum anomalous hole.
It's also a commensurate filling.
Within the simplest nearest neighbor models, Van Hoff filling is also a commensurate filling.
Not with two particles per unit cell. They see it one particle per unit cell.
Okay. Yeah. So, you know, and there's also some paper with signatures of flux order, but I don't want to sign up here and claim that, you know, any of these experiments are seeing this. You know, this is some very simplified toy model. It's assuming weak coupling. I don't know if weak coupling is valid for any experiment, but, you know, I'm hoping that, you know, there is some insight to be gained from this sort of analysis. You could also play this game on the square lattice. Just one slide on that. So if you played this game on the square lattice and you just increase your number of flavors, you do find something interesting. So when the number of flavors is 2, then remember the antiferromagnet and the superconductor were degenerate at the leading log squared order. But when you increase the number of flavors away from 2, then the leading instability actually becomes to a staggered flux state, just as on the honeycomb lattice. But it's now not a chiral staggered flux state, so it's a non-chiral sort of gap staggered flux state, which when you dope then gives way to a nodal D-wave superconductor. So just to conclude, you know, what I've told you today is that close to Van Hove filling with a nested Fermi surface, weak coupling can give access to a rich phase diagram with enhanced energy scales. And Parkett RG is a good way to tackle this problem. And flavor degeneracy in the Murray systems actually makes a crucial difference to the results of the Parkett RG. And on the honeycomb lattice in particular, or hexagonal lattices, what we find is that the leading weak coupling instability is to a churn insulator, which exhibits quantized anomalous Hall effect without any ordering in the spin valley sector. And on doping, this gives way to a chiral superconductor, so we get this sort of phase diagram. And you know, all the work here was done by my student, Yuping, at Boulder, and it's motivated by earlier work that I did with Leonid and Andre. So you know, with that, I'll conclude.
So Rahul, this is very nice. And we discuss weak coupling versus strong coupling.
Yes.
We discuss role of band structure.
Yes.
But disorder may play a role, because in the Moir pattern, I think this flavor symmetry is broken, because the twist angle fluctuates throughout the system.
Right.
That's one kind of disorder. There may be other kind of disorder.
Right.
So this is a general question to others also. Have people included disorder? I mean, you know, only way I know is do it then. Replica. I mean,
Right. Okay,
that's the only way I know it becomes numerical, but I think it's an important question,
Right. Because
I think you explained very well how important flavor degeneracy is.
In fact, you know, short-range correlated disorder would be more relevant than short-range interactions.
Right. This is what I'm asking. So has anybody done it at all? I mean, this can be done. I mean, it's not, it's some work, but all good things are some work.
Not as far as I am aware, but does anybody know?
We should talk about it, because this, you know, this short-range disorder, which definitely is there if you talk to the experimenters.
Right.
They don't understand its complete nature.
Right.
So the flavor degeneracy is probably lifted by this disorder to some extent.
Right.
Is there a way to understand the occurrence of the insulators at integer, as a sequence of integer fillings using recoupling?
Not with this Van Hove picture. I mean, certainly, you know, DEMA sees many more insulators than you would expect based on this sort of analysis. So the most we could hope for is that this may be describing some of the insulating phases. And then the others have to be understood in some other way.
You said it implicitly, but maybe can you say it one more time? What's the valley polarization in your states?
None.
It's singlets.
Yeah, so this state is in the trivial irrep of the SU4 spin valley group.
Just to wrap this discussion, question to both of you. In all other examples that at least I know about, FRG and Parkett RG gave qualitatively similar answers. There's difference in minor delta. Here, do you see the same state, or there's a qualitative difference between these two approaches?
Well, maybe. So if you look at Laura's results, so she gets the spin density wave for J equals 0, right? And I think the Hubbard case would be the one with all G's repulsive. So there seems to be a difference. But maybe this is because she's doing the flow at finite coupling. And then, as you say, initially the spin density wave is sort of the strongest, and it may also gain from the flat sides of the non-divergent flat sides of the Fermi surface. This might be another player, so that at most finite scales, the SDW is somewhat stronger than in your analysis, which focuses on it. So this is my rough understanding.
Sweet.
Okay, thanks very much. Let's start at 11:05.